You're listening to the Renzo Republic.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome to Remso Republic Live. Do me a quick favor. Go ahead and follow me on Twitter at Remso101. That's R-E-M-S-O-101. For those of you that are in a bit of a podcast deficit because we're on our season break for the Remso Republic podcast, hopefully doing these live streams more often during the off season will go ahead and keep you engaged. This gives me so much more time to cover current events, bring on people that have, you know, extremely difficult schedules that I've got, you know, record an episode with them like 3 months out in advance. And next thing you know, they may have ended up killing somebody or something like that, or they're in jail. And next thing you know, it's like, oh, we got to scrap the episode. Not that that's happened at all, but you know, it's a crazy, crazy world. But just to let you know, we do have new episodes of Live Free and Grow with Jason Carrier out on the Remso Republic podcast feed. So go ahead and you can listen to Jason talk about homesteading survival skills. Cryptocurrencies is something he's jumping into right now. You could listen to that if you want the audio only stuff. But thank you for being with us here tonight. There are very few instances lately, because I'm on such a crazy schedule, where I actually try and carve out time to read a physical book. And no, I'm not just like, oh, I'll tune in an audiobook on the car when I'm on the treadmill or something. I mean, like actual like paper books, like actual stuff. For the millennials out there, there used to be these things you would print out and you would actually have to turn the pages and stuff. But it's something interesting when I go ahead and take the time to actually say, okay, this is my dedicated reading time. And recently, as I was getting my list of books to go ahead and read as we get towards the holidays together, somebody recommended a book by Jeffrey Tucker from Fee. And I was like, well, I already read all his articles. Why would I want to go ahead and read a book he's doing? Why would I have to pay for that? I could read stuff for free. And they're like, bro, you've got to go ahead and get this book. It's called Right Wing Collectivism. I'm like, is that just what the book's about, or is that the actual name? And they're like, no, man, it's actually called Right Wing Collectivism. Go on Facebook right now, and some dude is like basically calling him, you know, a neoliberal and all this other stuff, and he's a leftist, all this other stuff, and it's like the right's going crazy. I'm like, okay, is it the right, or is it like the alt-right? And man, let me tell you, not only was the controversy just kind of out there, like we're pushing like, you know, Jewish banker conspiracy theory crazy, but I went ahead and ordered a copy of the book. I'm a few chapters away from finishing it, but the book is Right Wing Collectivism. And let me tell you, this is one of those things where it's like people have spoken about it here and there. People have tried to understand it, but nobody really knows it. Like, you could see it's like, oh, yeah, I could detect it here and there. But this book goes into so much more detail than any other source you could possibly go to. And with us tonight, I want to go ahead and bring on the author of the book, Jeffrey Tucker. Sir, how are you doing tonight? Thank you for coming on.
Listen, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm so glad to be here. And thank you for having me, and thanks for saying that. I do think the book is special. It's the only one I know of that tries to give a, you know, an overview of the philosophical heritage that the alt-right represents. It's not just the alt-right. I mean, it's a kind of a tendency that you see in politics in the U.S. and in Europe. And what I did is I dug really deeply into the history to figure out, you know, who are the philosophers? What are the ideas that gave rise to this stuff? I'm convinced that everybody is a kind of a slave of a dead philosopher. And I wanted to find out what that was. And so I discovered it. I feel like I discovered it. You know, I followed the breadcrumbs left by other scholars like Mises and Hayek and others. And I just laid it out.
Exactly. And that's the thing that people don't understand. They tend to think that it just happened like as soon as Trump became president. And I could, like, before I even really began to understand that this was an actual, like, you know, cultural movement to a large degree, I began to see it in the 2012 Republican primaries. You look back, you could see, you know, George McGovern running as independent for president. You go way back and you're touching the progressive era. When I've spoken to some people who are, I wouldn't call them alt-right, maybe alt-light to a degree, where it's like, yeah, you know, if the Indians stay in India, they'll be good. If the blacks stay in Africa, we'll be good. They're those types of folks to a large degree. They have been getting upset with the title, and it bugs me when they refuse to even read the book. Like, I read books by people that I'm like, okay, I might not like the person or the premise, but I'll go ahead and read it. And they're avoiding your book because they don't like the title, Right Wing Collectivism. And you say it pretty early on in the book. It's not inherently a right wing thing. You go ahead and you begin to take it down a little bit. Can you explain that?
Yeah, let me just back up a little bit. So I got the term right wing really comes out of a movement that began to develop in the early 19th century, growing out of Hegel's philosophy. You know, Hegel was a historicist, and he an anti-liberal in many ways. And he posited that there was an end of history, that history would take along its own trajectory that would be sort of meta, above human action, human choice. And this end point of history would be the state. And it would be the Prussian state and the Prussian church, in his case. But the Hegelians that came afterwards, and they're against laissez-faire, they're against the tendency that was going on in the world towards ever freer economies and human choice and freer markets and the commercial sector. And his movement broke into two halves. One was a left-wing variety and one was a right-wing variety. The left believed that the whole world was going to head in this trajectory towards a final state of, perfection. And Mises wrote this in 1956, that these people became the Marxists. On the other hand, there was a right-wing version of Hegelianism that eventually became the Nazis and the fascists. And I stand by the term right-wing here because I think we have to have some way to distinguish these two schools of thought. They tend to hate each other. I mean, the fascists and the communists have always been bitter opponents, you know, the Nazis and the communists. But on the other hand, in some ways, they're the two sides of the same coin, you know. But the reason I use the designation right wing is that I feel like we need to be able to distinguish people like, you know, Carl Schmitt and Thomas Carlyle and some of these other figures I'm talking about, Spengler and everything, from the hard Marxists that they opposed. You have to understand that both left and right versions were anti-libertarian. They're both anti-liberal. They both wanted to overthrow human choice and the free market. And the ennoblement that comes with a commercial society. So that's the reason for the title. And I agree with you. A lot of people have instinctively against it because they're going, oh, well, the fascists, the Nazis were not right-wing, they're left-wing. I defend it in the introduction. I take it on, you know, right at the outset.
Exactly. And, I mean, it's just... A common argument I'm hearing is, oh, well, why didn't he write a book about left-wing collectivism? And you go ahead and you look anywhere, and how many different ways do we need to do it? Like, we know that it exists. This is one of those things that within, you know, the liberty movement, the conservative movement, the moment you put right-wing on it, it became a trigger word for some people.
Oh, I know. And I should be clear, you know, I am really distinguishing. What I'm talking about is not, has nothing to do with traditional conservatism of the American sort. This is not Buckley. This is not Russell Kirk. This is not Edmund Burke. You know, this is not Alexander Hamilton, right? This is a foreign tradition. It's a complete Hegelianism that has very low regard for human choice, human liberty, human dignity, individualism, rights, the free market. None of this stuff plays any role, whereas it does play a role in traditional conservatism. So what I'm discussing, I think, is more correctly called right-wing Hegelianism, right? But I can't put that as a title. So I called it right-wing collectivism. I think it's a good designation. But it is really different. It departs as much from libertarianism as it does from, say, something like Burkean or Buckleyite conservatism.
Exactly. When people have been getting upset with this, do you think it's because it's a lack of knowledge, it's a lack of understanding, you know, the threats of the alt-right where this right-wing collectivism comes in? Or is it, as I've seen it, you tend to call out their own insecurities because now it's like, okay, these things that you think are okay here and there, when you actually look into it, you're buying into the same statist.
That's right.
Ideologies,
you know, one of the chapters in there covers, you know, the philosophical backdrop. I discuss some of the IQ obsessions of this crowd, and they're longing for a homogeneous demographic, right? So what's interesting to me is that this longing for a homogeneous demographic is something that you find in common with all anti-liberal or anti-libertarian schools. It became very intense in the late 19th century, to the point that it led to a big eugenics movement in the United States. There were left-wing and right-wing versions of the eugenics movement too. You know, there were left and right wing versions of the progressive of movement. But there, you know, what's interesting to me, there is nothing being said by the alt-right that wasn't being said more than 100 years ago by the rightist right wing progressive set. It's the same crowd. I mean, they were against diversity in the population. They were against free trade. They're for authoritarian forms of government. They're in favor of demographic planning based on scientific management. They wanted strongman rule. They wanted massive restrictions on immigration. They got them. In other words, I mean, alt-right ideology has already existed in American history.
That's the thing that just blows my mind, though. Right. Like, me and so many other people thought this was recent. Like, this started with Steve Bannon. This started with other people. And your book goes into it, and honestly, it's like reading a horror story, because it's like, holy crap. Like, we probably should have seen this coming. Yeah. And when it comes to this type of stuff, like people, like you said, they thought it was dead. They thought it was long and gone. And there's a part really early on in the book that was both funny in a way, but as I'm reading it, I'm just like, holy crap, these people are real. It's like saying you saw a chupacabra out in the woods. You had lunch with a Nazi.
Yeah, you're talking about my chapter on lunch with a Nazi. That's one of the few sections of the book that's actually autobiographical. And really, this did happen, you know, a long time ago. But
are you like on NaziDateFinder.com?
I don't know. You know, you know, this lunch was set up for me. And I remember distinctly who set it up. And it was a journalist living in Washington at the time who had met at a cocktail party or something like that. And he somehow thought that I needed to meet this lady. And I had no idea where I was going. But he said, she's very wealthy and she could take very good care of you. And it's very important that you meet her.
Well, that does it right there.
All right, here I go. So I went to this, you know, it was in Alexandria, Virginia, you know, an old town, you know, and I drove up and it was very fancy, you know, sort of tea room, luncheon. I was sitting there awkwardly waiting for this woman, and in she walks, you know, this you know, baroness, you know, this sort of wealthy, you know, heiress, widower, you know. And she, her hair is coiffed and blonde, and she's sashaying across the room in a fancy skirt and with a beautiful high-end perfume on, you know, and she just looked and smelled the part, you know. And I thought, well, this is interesting. This should be a fascinating lunch. And we began to talk, and she began to kind of press me, you know. I mean, just like test me and push me and test me and push me. And she starts, of course, with, America's going down the drain, the establishment's ruling everything, you know, what are we going to do about, you know, the elites and that are
the usual.
Yeah, you heard the world, the global financial establishment, and so on. And then she gets, you know, starts talking about the white race, and I'm thinking, well, that's a little strange, I don't know if I... And then eventually she gets to the Jews, you know. And I start to get really uncomfortable. You know, I'm just a nice boy from Texas. You know, I'd never really heard any kind of talk like this. And this is
what we do here in D.C. We just complain about the Jews and the elites on the regular.
Yeah, and I thought, well, this is getting a little awkward. And then finally, and she could tell that I was trying to kind of get, you know, squeamish, which obviously she had immense experience in dealing with, you know, people like me. And so she pulled back a little bit and just winked and smiled and lifted up her glass and wanted to raise a toast to the great man of the century, Adolf Hitler. And it wasn't until that moment I realized, oh my God, I'm having lunch with a Nazi. This is actually happening, you know. And again, she's like, you know, out of a Hollywood movie, right? She's just, her manners are perfect. I mean, I was mostly up until that moment worried about my etiquette, you know, my eating with my salad fork properly.
It's like you're describing a scene from Indiana Jones or something.
And, you know, I felt very, in telling the story, I noticed when I wrote about my article, I didn't say whether I toast or not. To tell you the truth, I have a vague sense of having, you know, like clinked to Hitler. I'm not sure that I did, you know, I can't reconstruct it well enough.
Well, you know, win in Rome, toast to Hitler, I guess.
but then she winked at me and, you know, soon the lunch closed. I said, well, listen, I must be going, you know, all the best to you. And it was air kisses. And my heart was racing wildly. I thought, what just happened to me? And how did this happen? And why? And why was she interested in me? You know, why was I having lunch with a Nazi? And I just walked as quickly as I could out of the restaurant and got in my car and just kind of like, you know, once I was safe in my car, I was just sort of huffing and puffing. And I never entirely figured it out. Actually, I did more or less realize that the man who had set up the lunch, of course, was very much connected with her foundation, which is a very wealthy foundation. They gave it a lot of money. And they're funding a lot of the sort of nascent Nazi movement that existed in that part of the world, you know, including many activist groups in Washington at the time. And she was a major funder of them. And she was trying to vet me to see if she could, I don't know, bring me around to that point of view.
Well, you did clink for Hitler, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to say she never contacted me again, but it was...
That's a good thing.
I think it was at that point that I began to get a little wary, you know. I have to tell you, you know, the funny thing about this kind of demonic ideological movements is that you don't really learn about them in college in the sense that you don't really encounter them. Maybe it's different today because I think you do have.
I just recently graduated and I went to Liberty University, so instantly you can tell our worldview. But you know, growing up, it's like you look at World War II for an example. And it was everyone versus the Nazis. And then it's not until I go to Liberty and I was a government major where...
Well, yeah, some of the Nazis were all dead, right? I mean, that's the thing.
All of them.
History. Yeah. I mean, the idea of...
The bad guys were defeated, so there is no evil.
Oh, the whole thing is ridiculous. I think our history understanding is so terrible.
But it's illiterate to a large degree.
We think, oh, the world's going along great, and then some dude in a mustache kind of whipped up a bunch of Germans into a frenzy and then threw a bunch of Jews in a gas chamber. But fortunately, U.S. rode to the rescue, wiped out the bad guy, and we made the world safe again. And then that's the end of the story. I mean, none of this is true. I mean, the Nazi movement itself was a long time coming. It was decades in the building. In fact, it was a century in the building, longer than a century. I don't really have a chapter of the rise of the Nazis, but I can tell you a very interesting story about it. I mean, it was really the perfect storm that gave rise to this movement that had been building as a revolt against the modern world for 150 years before it culminated in this and Hitler, who in many ways, you know, didn't lead a movement. He absorbed the energy of a diverse movement that had been building for a very, very long time. It was just an attempt to sort of turn back the clock on liberalism. But what was interesting to me about that, by the way, many of Hitler's ideas he took from the American eugenic experiments. You know, when I go into that and into the book and in some detail, I mean, a lot, it's very uncomfortable for Americans, but a lot of what happened under the Nazis was actually
adopted. Inspired, yeah, because they were going to Harvard, they were going to all of our academic institutions, and they were watching people, and they were like, "Oh, these guys are onto something."
Now. No, American academia pre-gamed Nazism long before there was Hitler, so you know that was actually going on.
It's terrifying when you look at the world now. It's like, oh crap.
Yeah. But anyway, the point is that this stuff doesn't actually go away. And I had not been exposed to it. But it's been for my whole career sort of gradually encountering this alternative. It's kind of an anti-leftist, radical, hardcore statism. And I began to get sensitive to it. And right before I heard Trump speak in July, I think, of 2015.
It was that Freedom Fest.
I had just read Mises' book Omnipotent Government, about which is a book entirely based on right wing collectivism, essentially. This is the whole book. And I had just read the book. So in many ways, my book is a follow up to Mises' 1944 work. And when I heard Trump talk, and I'm not here to say, Trump's a Nazi. He's a very good marketer of an ideology, and he's very good at understanding sort of, what the people want to hear. And he gave voice to this firmament that was already out there. Which is not pro-free market. It's not pro-liberalism. It's not in favor of the commercial society. It's not in favor of ever more diversity and the free association. It's another version of Essential Plan. And, I sniffed it out very quickly in July 2015. And the people sitting around me did not and could not understand why I was so shaken, by the speech. So it was at that point that I realized I had a job to do. I had a job to explain this philosophical tradition, get people sensitized, to understanding it, developing a good nose for it, developing an instinct to sniff out what this alternative form of statism looks like. So that's essentially what I sought to do. I sought to like train people to understand what this threat to liberty really is, and which is the reason for the subtitle of the book, The Other Threat to Liberty.
And it's so, like, the scary thing about that chapter, my Lunch of a Nazi, is, you brought up when you first heard Trump speak, and then that, and that's a good amount of time from when those two incidents happened. And the one thing you discuss in that chapter is that she had been a financier for all these organizations, for all these individuals. Yep. Have, I'm trying to find a non-conspiratorial way to say this, because it sounds like I'm about to start screaming Illuminati New World Order and stuff, so I apologize. But it almost seems like this stuff, it went under our nose for the longest time, because when you look at post the Berlin Wall coming down, it's like our focus is entirely on communism and everything else. And
that's right.
Slowly coming up. And it just seems like it when it came out in 2015, 2016, it seems like we just got sucker punched. Why do you think we ignored
it? You're right. It was there all the time. In fact, I have a little bit towards the end, you'll bump into it, a timeline of right collectivism, right-wing collectivism. It takes us from 1820 all the way up to, I think the last figure I mentioned here is from the 1970s, and I stop. Mainly because I realize that's a different book. And I'm interested, although I'm a little bit, how do I put it? Like, I'm a little
hesitant.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to get us from the 1970s up to the present. I think maybe it's too soon to reconstruct that history. But there's no question there was a quasi-Nazi movement the entire time that was alive and well in this country, perpetuated by two or three very wealthy guys. And, some literature. This is long before the internet. They were writing novels and developing a movement. It was always out there. They had a newspaper. There were underground newspapers. And the funny thing is that these movements really developed partially because they were so taboo. It's like, think of your alt-right friends. I mean, they love being bad boys, saying and thinking impermissible thought.
The white race is dying. And it's like,
yeah, right.
You got to calm down.
Well, you can go back to what was that, a 1912 book, The Passing of the Great Race, by Madison Grant. And I discuss him in great length at the book. The Madison Grant dude who wrote this best-selling book, The Passing of the Great Race. And the early part of the 20th century, it was like on every coffee table,
That book was actually referenced in The Great Gatsby the beginning. Yeah. It's like, you got to read this book. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, it's so funny. And so you combine that with Spenglerian historicism and racial panic from the white people. And by the way, back a century ago, the white people were not, they weren't concerned about, I don't know, what are people concerned about, Mexicans today or something. I don't know what people are concerned about, or, Islam or something like that.
Given the year, we'll be screaming about the Canadians.
Yeah, right. But back then, they worried about three main groups: the Slavs, the Southern Italians, and the Jews, right? So, but even back then, the Irish were not considered to be white people, and the Jews certainly weren't considered to be white people. So the only people who were really white people a century ago, according to the eugenics movement and the white nationalist movement at the time, were, basically Germano-English, Anglo-Saxon, Protestants of a particular variety, certainly not Catholics. And certainly not Jews, or certainly not like Slavs, you know, but they were not considered to be white people, or much less Italians. So, you know, I mean, this stuff is really grim. I'm so sensitive to it now. I mean, like, we've been there and we've done that. It led to terrible things a century ago. I mean, it led to Jim Crow laws and segregation and highly regulated labor markets, massive immigration restrictions, marriage licenses. Just terrible things across the board. There's nothing good that came out of this movement. And it's weird to me that like a century later, you've got all these young dudes going, hey, here's something new. I never really thought of it that way. Well, the white race is under threat, you know?
It really shocks me though, because there are a lot of people that, you know, they were in the liberty movement. We did so much awesome stuff together. Now they're basically saying, I will never apologize for the West and everything else. And it's like, you're not even like, you're creating a historical narrative. It's not that, you know, one day there was a place called Europe where all the white people just frolicked in the fields and they were so happy. And then the Jews came. And it's like, that never happened. They were out killing each other. The Brits were enslaving the Irish and everything else. And it gets so upsetting. And then they're like, well, you know, Remso, we can only have your drug addicted, prostitute ridden libertarian utopia if we could just have all the white people come together. And I'm like, dumbass, I'm Puerto Rican and my mom's from Korea. Where do I fit into all of this? And it's so shocking, because now amongst people I considered my friends, suddenly I have to justify my own existence.
This is the heartbreaking thing about this. If you lived in Brazil, nobody would be talking about your race. If you lived in Israel, nobody would be talking about your race. I mean, in most places in the world, you're not required to declare your race, because everything's really complicated, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is really, in some sense, no such thing as a pure race anywhere. In America, we have a very weird system inherited from this eugenic past, where on every form, and I'm sure it must drive you crazy. I mean, it drives
me. FAFSA hates me. Affirmative action didn't know where to put me.
Oh, geez. I hate it. I don't, I mean, I think regular people should be offended at any form that is like asking you to declare your race. And, you know, the categories are getting a little more complicated. What are we up to, like 9 or something like that?
But they're splitting Latinos in like 7 different areas. Like, I don't know if I go in like the Hispaniola category or the Latino category.
I mean, all my friends off the board say that America has invented this category of person called Latino or Hispanic to describe basically everybody down there. Like everybody like here. I mean, what are we doing? I mean, I don't know. I think we're rid of this total obsession and recognize that the beauty of human liberty is that brings people together according to their own choices. And so we can all benefit from each other's presence in the world. I mean, to me, that's a really beautiful aspect of liberalism that we've forgotten about. And I don't like it. The left is race obsessed and the right is race obsessed. I think libertarians have a contribution to make here to say, hey, everybody chill, you know, let's just get along.
Exactly. So, sir, I've got to let you go. People, folks, my homies, come on, do me a favor. Go ahead and get a copy of Right Wing Collectivism. Give it to your crazy progressive aunt, your ultra right wing uncle in Alabama. Sir, how can they get a copy of your book?
You can go over to Amazon and get it. And I'm making an audiobook now too. So, but run over to Amazon, pick it up, review it. It's gotten really great reviews. I'm really happy. The introduction is by David McCloskey, the greatest living economic historian. So I've been really thrilled with the reception. I'm maybe someday I'll write part two and get us able to examine where the alt-right came from more recently. We'll see what happens.
Let's hope that has a happy ending in some way. But sir, thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Stay up to date with the latest news and updates by visiting
RenzoRepublic.com.